All right, well, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk. And what I'd like to do is tell you a little bit about a brief introduction to what we've called the magnetic racetrack memory. This is a technology which we would believe will eventually replace all hard disk drives and all non-volatile memory. That's our goal. And so the basis of this memory is the idea that we can move magnetic domain walls with current. And you've already heard a very beautiful talk this morning by Hideo Ono on the motion of domain walls in magnetic semiconductors. And I'm going to talk about the motion of domain walls through current in magnetic metals. But, as I said, I first want to briefly introduce this concept of the magnetic racetrack to tell you why we're interested in this particular phenomenon. And before I do that, I want to just introduce, acknowledge several members of my group who've been involved in this work. And in particular, I see you can't read their names, but Luke Thomas and Masamitsu Hayashi. So I'm sorry for the color seems to be wrong. And also Jin Jiang and Bastian Bergman, Charlie Redner, and Rai Mariah. So let's just a brief introduction, and this is of course a physics conference, so you're totally probably uninterested in technologies, but nevertheless, your lives totally depend on certain technologies, and these are the two. One is magnetic disk drives. So you store, like this torque is stored on a magnetic disk drive, but to take advantage of that torque, we have to move the information to memory, random access memory. And so most computing devices today involve a very complicated hierarchy of memories based on extremely fast but expensive memories like static random access memory to memories which are much less expensive like dynamic random access memory. It's also much less fast. And then finally, there's the hard disk drive, which is incredibly slow but incredibly cheap. So this is at the other end of the spectrum. And beyond that, in fact, there's magnetic tape, which is also an important technology. So, point is that today, magnetic disk drives, where we store most information, are actually quite unreliable, and would be nice to have a memory that was more reliable, and at the same time, non-volatile, and incredibly cheap, with greater performance. And if we could do that, we could replace disk drives, and of course, most non-volatile memories. And that is our goal, particularly since IBM, we sold our disk drive business 4 years ago, our memory business 10 years ago. So we just want to now we've sold those parts of our business, we can attempt to replace them. That's the idea. Something else. So, and it turns out today, because of the change in the applications and the technologies, there's a very important need for non-volatile memory. And so there's a lot of new types of memories, some of which have been around for many years, 30 years in the case of phase change memory, 50 years for magnetic memories. But there's a lot of interest today and a resurgence of interest in trying to develop interesting new non-volatile memories with combinations of properties that are useful for various applications. And I'm not really going to discuss those in any detail. This is the one I want to discuss, the one that we're working on. And we've called it this magnetic racetrack. And the idea is very, very simple, that in silicon technologies, the cost of silicon technology is largely determined by the area of the silicon which is used to develop a particular memory bit. And so one approach to building less expensive memories is to, of course, reduce the cell size. And this is what happens why DRAM is cheaper than SRAM. It has a smaller cell size, but you have to give up performance for that. Now, in order to truly build a memory with the cost of a disk drive, we have to reduce the cell size by a factor of 100. And that seems to be very difficult to do, particularly given that in the next 5 years, then a typical dimension in a semiconductor memory will be below 30 nanometers. So instead of building then devices on the scale of 3 nanometers, we could instead try to put very many bits in the same area as today we put, we have one bit. Can we put 100 bits of information in the same area of silicon that today we store one bit? If we can do that without adding any cost, we could reduce the cost per bit by a factor of 100. So our philosophy is the most interesting new memories are those which involve accessing multiple bits, multiple states in one area of silicon. And this is what we want to do, but in a way that hasn't been done before by using magnetic domain walls. And this morning, then you heard a lot about the motion of domain walls. And this is a phenomenon that's also been known for many years, the idea that because of conservation of spin angular momentum, when you pass a current from one side to the other side of a magnetic domain wall, so on the two sides the moments are pointing in opposite direction, and then if the electron spin moment follows adiabatically the local magnetization direction, you're changing its spin and therefore you're changing its angular momentum, and this therefore will cause a magnetic domain wall to move, as was discussed earlier. Now it turns out that the understanding of this interaction of the current and the magnetization is, I would say, in a state of some debate today, as was discussed this morning. This is a foil that I've taken from Satomichi Mayakawa, and in which he argues that as the electrical current passes across a domain wall, then the moments rotate, as shown here, in the plane of this wire. Whereas Jen Tatara, who's here at the meeting, will tell you that rather the magnetic moments will rotate out of the plane during this process of the interaction with the current. We're going to come back to that in a little bit later. But the basic idea then, which is new, is that by simply passing a current pulse across a domain wall, we can cause the domain wall to move a finite distance. And the distance will be proportional to the length of the current pulse under some circumstances. That won't always be the case. So I just wanted to, in sense, just briefly mention then the theoretical models, if you like, from an experimentalist point of view, largely rely on whether or not the electron spin does indeed follow adiabatically the local magnetization direction. And the consequences are quite profound. So that, for example, if in the adiabatic limit where the electron spin does follow the local magnetic moment direction, then there will be, if we increase the amount of spin angular momentum, increase the amount of current we flow across this domain wall, there will be no motion, no velocity of the domain wall until a certain threshold current is reached. And then the velocity will increase. So this represents the delivery of spin angular momentum. This is the velocity of the domain wall. So in the adiabatic limit, there will be a threshold current below which there will be no motion of the domain wall. Now, on the other hand, in the when we have non-adiabaticity, when the electron spin direction lags behind the local magnetization direction, and we're going to describe that by a parameter beta representing the non-adiabatic contribution to this interaction, in those circumstances, there will be motion of the domain wall even for zero current, in the limit of zero current across the domain wall. And in the case, a special case, when beta equals alpha, then the velocity of the domain wall will increase linearly with the spin angular momentum delivered across the domain wall. So I just want to make that distinction between these two models. We're going to come back to that in some of our experiments a little bit later on. So why is spin torque so interesting? Very simply, the interest is that in conventionally, of course, people have tried to use domain walls to build interesting memory and logic elements for 50 years. And the dynamics under magnetic field are such that domain walls with opposite polarity will move in opposite directions. Because simply, when you apply a magnetic field, eventually all the magnetization wants to line up in the direction of the magnetic field. So domain walls with opposite polarity will move in opposite directions. Now, with current, it's quite different. And here are some simulations. This is as a function of time. The blue represents a magnetic wire with some constrictions, which are irrelevant here. Red and blue represent moments parallel or antiparallel to this wire. And you can see when we apply current pulses, then the two domain walls here, the blue, red, red, blue, different chiralities, then move in the same direction. And this is because the current in magnetic metals can be very strongly spin polarized through spin-dependent scattering. So in permalloy, the current is about 90% polarized, means 90% of the current is carried by majority spin electrons. And this is repolarized very rapidly, so that the current here is polarized in this blue direction and will move the domain wall in that blue direction. The current at the second domain wall becomes polarized in the red direction, therefore moves domain wall in the same direction. So this is very interesting. We can move domain walls of, again, opposite signs in the same direction. And in principle, if we reverse the current direction, negative current, then the domain walls will move in the opposite direction. So it's a very simple point. current dynamics quite different, current-driven dynamics quite different from field-driven dynamics. And that led us to consider building this type of memory. So the idea is very, very simple. We're going to make a tall column of magnetic material, the racetrack. And here is a silicon wafer. We're going to build a column about 10 microns tall and 0.1 microns wide. It's an aspect ratio of 100 to 1. It's a non-trivial thing to do, but it has been done. And then the idea is, in the surface of this silicon wafer, we're going to build a small element for writing the main walls into the racetrack, and a second small element for reading those domain walls as they pass by. So it's easy to do in PowerPoint, and you can see, here we are. We have a series of current pulses, put in a current pulse, and this whole sequence of domain walls will move around this racetrack. So in this case, this column, the racetrack, has to be twice as long as the length of those domain wall information bits. And in this case, you can see as the domain walls move over what will be a magnetic tunneling junction sensor, then we can detect dynamically the presence of these domain walls. That's the idea. Now, if we can build a column in the same area as these devices and store 100 domain walls, then we can increase the capacity of a conventional silicon-based memory by this factor of 100. If we could do 100, then we could replace a disk drive. If we can do a factor of 10, we can replace flash memory. And the performance of such a memory like this will depend on several criteria. It's going to depend largely on how quickly we can move the domain walls up and down the magnetic racetrack. So that depends on what is the current-induced domain wall velocity. And I want to come back and discuss that a little bit later. Again, it was discussed by Hideo this morning. So I'm not going to go into any more detail about this, our approach, except to say that we plan to read these domain walls through the fringing fields that are developed at a domain wall boundary. So because there's a divergence of magnetization, you can have very large local fringing fields, magnetostatic fields, and we could use those fields as the domain wall moves by a magnetoresistive element. The fringing field will change the magnetic state of, for example, a tunnel junction device, and we could use that to read very quickly the presence of these domain walls. Now, writing, we plan to use an approach like this. We plan to have a small neighboring magnetic wire specially designed that it would contain a single domain wall. And as we move this domain wall underneath the racetrack, then again, we can use the fringing fields to write information into the racetrack. And again, if I just use PowerPoint here, then you can see the idea is that the this neighboring domain wall and this neighboring wire, we move it again with a current pulse underneath the racetrack. And the fringing field, you can see, changes this region from red to blue. And so this is a very interesting magnetic writing element because we can develop local magnetic fields of the order of several thousand oersteds, which we can move locally and so create extremely localized fields for this purpose. So in summary, we believe that this notion of building a racetrack here, we have a real racetrack connected at the top and bottom. In reality, that would be rather tough to do. But the idea is very simple then. We have mechanisms for writing and reading magnetic regions into these columns, and we could then increase the storage capacity of conventional solid-state memory a factor of 10 to 100 times. And depending upon the domain wall velocity, it will take essentially half, on average, half the length of this column to move the domain wall to a reading element, and that should take of the order of 50 nanoseconds if the domain walls can be moved at approximately 1,000 meters per second. And that's the goal. So now, in principle, we're going to build this column with these, what I'm going to call notches. These are local pinning potentials where the domain walls will sit. Now, it turns out that the energy of the domain wall is influenced mostly by demagnetizing fields. So wherever we have some curvature of the wall, then that will minimize the domain wall energy. So whether we have a shrinkage or an expansion of the size of this column, it will cause the domain wall to want to sit at that particular position. So the idea is to have a series of well-defined local pinning sites for these domain walls, and then move them from one to another. So that's the reason why we want to look at the physics of motion of domain walls under current and field between notches in magnetic wires. So now we're currently building these, attempting to build these columns and with these reading and writing elements, but most of our experiments are on simpler structures where we use two-dimensional wires in the two-dimensional plane for the purposes of exploring the motion of domain walls under field and current. And that's what I'd like to discuss in the next little while. So again, we can simulate the motion of these domain walls. So if we have a series of notches and a series of four domain walls, you can see in the simulation, by applying current in one direction and another, and then in the opposite direction, we can effectively move the four domain walls from one set of notches to the next and back again. And now, however, for the same wire under same parameters, under slightly different conditions, and sometimes we have a little bit of problem, and in this simulation, you can see that two valuable bits of information were lost because these domain walls traveled at slightly different velocities. So this is why we need to fully understand the motion of domain walls to see whether or not this notion makes any sense, is actually practical. So now, what I'd like to do now is look at, somebody asked this question this morning, how does the, what's the dependence on the domain wall structure? So we've looked at that rather carefully, and I'd like to just show you some experiments as to how we've done that. So again, we're going to make a magnetic wire by electron beam lithography, create a small notch, we're going to inject a domain wall, and then we're going to apply either field or current pulses and see what current is needed to move the domain wall from that notch. So we can, using just very conventional electron beam lithography and optical contact lithography, we can build wires. This is a permaloid wire with a small notch for domain wall trapping. And typically, the wires we're considering are in the range of 100 to 300 nanometers wide, and the length of these wires ranges from one to several tens of microns. And we're going to use some contacts to create the domain walls in that wire. So we can also probe then the structure of the domain walls we inject into that wire by using magnetic force microscopy. So I just want you to, since we're going to talk a lot in the next few foils about vortex domain walls and transverse domain walls, just want to show you that we can clearly distinguish in permalloy these two types of domain wall. So first, on the left-hand side, this is the topography of our wire. We have a wire here with four notches. This is an atomic force microscopy image. Here it's connected to some other structures. This is not our usual structure. And here at this notch, you can see a vortex domain wall. So this is the magnetic force microscopy image in which you basically reveal the divergence of the magnetization. So if we simulate then with using just standard parameters for permalloy, we can simulate both the magnetization distribution shown in this color wheel here, where red, blue, yellow, and green represent the four directions of magnetization. And on the right-hand side is a simulation of the divergence of the magnetization, which you can see agrees quite well with our measured image. And then here we see a transverse domain wall, and again, here is the divergence plot of magnetization. And it agrees quite well with our experimental observation of that domain wall. So we can clearly see, I think you can see, clearly distinguish the vortex and transverse domain walls. The vortex wall, essentially, in the MFM, looks like a combination of two neighboring transverse walls, because it basically it's closed magnetization in on itself. Now, it turns out that I'm going to show you in a moment that we can see at the same structure, we can see a whole series of different domain walls for the same wire under very similar conditions of preparation of the domain walls. And here you can see seven different domain wall structures. Four of them are vortex structures and three transverse wall structures. The difference basically is the chirality of the vortex and transverse walls and the position of these walls with respect to the notch, whether they sit above or below the notch or exactly at the notch. So we have many metastable domain wall states And the reason for this is that if we calculate the energy of these domain wall structures, you can see that the energy is very similar for all of these domain wall structures. So we're going to do a very simple experiment. So I'm just going to run through how we do this experiment. We have a wire with a single notch. And then across the wire, we've created some contact pads. These are made of rhodium. And we're going to use these contact pads both to measure the resistance of the wire and to pass current through the contact pad without passing the current into the wire to generate a local magnetic field to create a domain wall. So initially, we're going to pass a current along this contact wire, and if we then calculate the distribution of field underneath this wire, you can see that the Oersted field can be quite large. It can be several hundred Oersteds, depending upon the current, and it strongly falls off at the edges of the wire. So this, what does that mean? That means if we, first we magnetize the wire with a large magnetic field in the left direction, so the wire is blue. We then pass a current in the appropriate direction that the current magnitude is such that the local magnetic field exceeds the nucleation field for domain wall in the wire, and we now have reversed magnetization underneath the wire. We've created two domain walls. Now by then we subsequently apply a small bias field. I'm also going to call that the injection field. And that injection field, as I mentioned earlier, will cause the two domain walls to move in opposite directions. So the domain wall on the left leaves the wire, because we've designed the wire so that this pointed structure at the end cannot support a domain wall. On the other hand, the domain wall on the right-hand side then moves into the wire. So you see now we have a single domain wall in the wire. And when this bias field exceeds the propagation field along the wire, the domain wall will move and remove to the notch. The propagation field along the wire is determined essentially by the roughness of the edges of these wires, and typically is in the range of 5 to 10 Oersteds. So now we've controllably nucleated and pinned the domain wall in this wire at the notch or near the notch, and we can probe its existence very simply by looking at the resistance of the wire using the phenomenon of anisotropic magnetic resistance. So the domain wall, let's say we take a transverse wall, will have a small transverse component of magnetization. And the resistance of most ferromagnetic metals depends on the orientation of the magnetic moment with respect to the current direction. So in this wire, the resistance is maximized when the moment is along the wire. And this small transverse component reduces the resistance very slightly. Now, it turns out that the drop in resistance in the presence of the domain wall is bigger for a vortex wall than a transverse wall, because there is more perpendicular or transverse moment in a vortex wall compared to a transverse wall. And we can actually calculate then the drop in resistance for a vortex wall in this permalloy wire compared to a transverse wall, and you can see it's about 50% bigger for a vortex compared to a transverse wall. So what do? We inject in a series of experiments a domain wall. Here's exactly this procedure I described. We magnetize a wire, pass a current through the contact pad, we create two domain walls, we apply a small injection field, we have a single domain wall in the wire, and we carry out this experiment many times. What we find then is a histogram of the number of times we measure a particular resistance of the wire after we've injected a domain wall. And you can see, I think very carefully, clearly, we have four well-defined resistance values. So if you like, the wire resistance is quantized, and it's because we have four different domain walls with different probabilities of being formed in the wire. So I think it's quite beautiful. We can clearly distinguish four different domain wall structures. We have, under exactly the same conditions, different metastable domain wall states at the notch. Now we can go back and after we've injected these domain walls, now this shows you a series of experiments in which we varied the injection field. So this is the experiment, the distribution of resistances of the wire with zero injection field. And then with two Oersteds injection field, then we've increased it to larger and larger values. And you can see that the histogram of distribution of these states will vary with the injection field. Now on the right-hand side, what we can do is we can inject. The domain will measure the resistance and then go to the MFM to measure the look at the magnetic state. And here are the four states that we observe. There are two vortex states and two transverse wall states. And they correspond to whether or not the transverse wall, here is the magnetic force image. You can see in this case, the transverse wall sits at the notch. In this case, it sits to one side of the notch. And it turns out that, of course, as you'd expect, the transverse wall, when it's in the notch, will give rise to a larger decrease in resistance than when it sits to the side of the notch. And we can distinguish these two conditions very easily from the resistance change. So we can inject domain walls of known structure. So that means we can now depin the domain walls of known structure from the notch, first with magnetic field. So we've created the domain wall, and we now apply a magnetic field until it depins. So we just simply continue to measure resistance. Eventually, resistance goes back to the original value where there is no domain wall in the wire. And we can see the field here is 45 oersteds. And then we can do the same thing. That was for a vortex wall. We can do the same thing for a transverse wall, and we see that the field required to depin a transverse wall is much larger. And that's also fairly easy to understand. The vortex wall is bigger, and therefore it senses the local pinning potential less well than the transverse wall. So we can then do that for all these states, for all these conditions of injection. And on the right-hand side, what we're plotting then is the field required to depin these domain walls with these four different domain wall states when we apply fields in the negative or positive direction. So we can move the domain wall from the notch to the left or to the right. And it turns out that in some cases there's an asymmetry. But I think you can see that the value of these depinning fields are independent of the injection field. So the domain walls basically look the same irrespective of this injection field. One point here then is that the fields required to depin the domain walls depend on their structure and where they sit in the domain wall. So this is shown here just to re-emphasize it. Here is the probability then of depinning these different types of domain walls with field. You can see they're very different. Now I want to do the same thing with current. We're now going to apply current pulses 4 nanoseconds long through this wire, and we're going to see what current is needed to remove the domain wall from the wire by simply inspecting after the passage of a 4 nanosecond long current pulse whether the resistance of the wire has changed. And so we see that, and what do we find then? We find that the critical current density needed to depin the domain wall looks like this in zero field. It's about 5 × 10⁸ amps per square centimeter. It's a big number. As we increase the field, we see this dependence. In zero current, the field is about 45 oersteds for this vortex wall, and you can see a weak dependence at low field on this critical current density. Now we can do the same experiment then with the transverse wall. What do we find? Kind of surprisingly, we find even though the depinning fields are quite different, the current is the same. You see here the current density required to depin a vortex and a transverse wall is essentially the same. Now, about, in this case, 5 × 10⁸ amps per square centimeter. Now, question is, as also was discussed this morning, these current densities are so big that in fact the wire heats up significantly. And again, we can measure the heating simply by measuring in real time the resistance of the wire during the current pulse. And here on a time scale of a few nanoseconds, you can see that the temperature of the wire equilibrates very rapidly within a few nanoseconds to a resistance which is higher than the resistance without any current. So you see the resistance change can be almost a factor of 2. Well, for permalloy, which is a resistive metal, that means a huge increase in temperature. And so we can reduce that temperature increase by simply changing the thermal link of the wire to the substrate. So here we've changed from silicon oxide, where we did our original experiments, to silicon, which is a better thermal conductor. And for the same current pulse, the heating or the change in resistance is about twice as small. So now we can normalize these current densities. Because we're using a constant voltage rather than a constant current pulse, then in fact, because of the increased resistance, the current densities are about twice as low if we normalize for that increased resistance of the wire due to temperature. The question is, does the domain wall de-pin before or after the heating? So this means that we really don't know the critical current density within this factor due to this heating. And the timescales appear to be very similar for both these phenomena. Now, nevertheless, we can see the same critical current for the transverse and vortex walls in low field. So let's summarize. We had these four states. So now this is a summary then for these four domain wall states of the critical current needed to de-pin this transverse wall, two varieties, one at the notch, one to the side, as a function of plus and minus field. And you can see then that when the domain wall, vortex or transverse, sits to one side of the notch, there's a very asymmetric dependence of this critical current on field. Because in one case, the domain wall has to pass through the notch, in the other case, it passes along the wire away from the notch. However, what you can see from here is that irrespective of the domain wall structure and where the domain wall sits, in low magnetic fields, the current densities after renormalization for temperature resistance increase are about the same. And what does this mean? Well, we can also now, this is a more detailed plot of the critical current versus field, where we basically looked at the resistance state after applying combinations of field and current. The blue, and this is the color code, represents the resistance of the wire. Blue is the resistance with no domain wall, and then the color represents vortex and transverse walls. And what you can see is that in this simple case here, the domain wall is de-pinned at these threshold fields, and in some cases you can see before the domain wall is de-pinned, the structure clearly changes from this structure with a lower resistance, more like a vortex structure, to this structure with an intermediate resistance, which is a transverse wall. So we can see changes in the structure of the walls before they de-pin from the notch with current. So it's rather complicated. And we can see this here. If we take a wire, this case with several notches, here is the domain wall. And you can see as we apply current pulses, which are not large enough to de-pin the domain wall, we can see changes in the structure of the domain wall with successive current pulses from vortex to transverse and back again. So the question is the current density the same because the wire is heated up and at these high temperatures, the motion of a vortex and a transverse wall makes little sense. So we don't really know the answer to that question currently. Now I also wanted to briefly, without going into any details, the same types of experiments, we can look at the critical current needed to move deep in domain walls of different structures as a function of the pinning potential. So by changing the notch depth and geometry, we can change the pinning potential. And I wanted to just show you these results. Basically, we find that even though the field required to de-pin the domain wall is significantly dependent on the notch, the deeper the notch, the bigger the field, the critical current we find to de-pin the domain walls appears to be independent of the notch potential for a factor of about 100 times, a range of 100-fold in pinning potential. So that's, again, a surprising result. So the conclusion here is that the current needed to de-pin a domain wall is both insensitive to the domain wall structure and insensitive to the pinning potential when we vary the pinning potential by a factor of 100. This actually appears to be consistent to Jen Tatara's model of the interaction of current with domain walls, and he has demonstrated that this current would be independent of the pinning potential almost down to atomically narrow constrictions. It's a little bit surprising. So, that summarizes this part of the talk. You can see that we can look in some detail at the current and field motion and depinning of domain walls from pinning sites. And we find this rather surprising result that the critical current density is insensitive to the domain wall structure and to the pinning potential. From a technology point of view, this is fantastic, because it means now in our racetrack we can develop whatever domain walls, whatever notches, and yet they should all move with the same current density. So if this is true, this is truly extremely favorable. I want to briefly mention, because I want to save some time for some more other more interesting results, I want to briefly mention that we can also measure the domain wall velocity. And again, that's very simple. We use the resistance of the wire to measure the time for which a domain wall resides in the wire. So again, we're going to inject a domain wall, and the domain wall will then be moved along the wire with a small field, and we're going to measure in real time just the resistance of the wire after we've injected a domain wall. And so this is the idea. With time, we inject the domain wall, we move it with field, and the current pulse is along the wire. The resistance will be reduced. It turns out in our experiment it looks like an increased signal, and that's what we do. So we reset. This is the slow part of the experiment. We have to reset the wire magnetization to have no domain wall. We're going to inject a domain wall using the process I described earlier. The resistance of the wire is lowered, and then we're going to apply a field with this current pulse to see the domain wall move along the wire and how much time it spends in the wire. And you can see we can get the velocity then from the time the resistance of the wire was lowered. And these two contacts are 4 microns apart. So then this is the result. This is the change in the signal from the voltage along the wire as a function of time after the injection of the domain wall. And you can see if we take this time here, for example, is about 40 nanoseconds. So we divide by 4 microns, the domain wall is moving at 100 meters per second. So we can measure in real time the motion of this domain wall as shown here. Now you'll notice that this actually is in order to get enough signal, we have to repeat this measurement 15,000 times. So this is a superposition of 15,000 injections and motion of the domain wall along the wire. And interestingly, you can see that whereas the signal rapidly increases at the beginning, so the injection is well defined, when the domain wall exits the wire, there's a rather broad, the signal decreases, there's a broadening. The question is, what causes that broadening? We think it's most likely due to a distribution of domain wall velocities, although there are other possible explanations. So that's the idea. The domain wall is in the wire, out of the wire, and we have this interesting distribution, possibly, of domain wall velocities. I don't want to talk about this in too much detail, because I'm sure you're all very familiar with the notion, the field-driven motion of domain walls in wires. Here's the field, and if you look at very small currents, the open symbols, these two, then it's well known that the domain wall velocity will increase linearly with a field, till a certain field, the famous Walker breakdown field, when the mobility is negative. And the domain wall velocity decreases to a minimum value and then increases with further increases in the dry field. So this is our experiments then indeed show exactly this Walker breakdown. The Walker breakdown field corresponds to turbulent motion of the domain wall above that field. Now then on this plot, you can see what happens when we apply, in addition to these fields, currents in the positive or negative directions. And what we see then is that the velocity of the domain wall can be increased or decreased by about 100 meters per second by applying these current pulses. So we see a very significant influence of the current on the domain wall velocity. Another interesting effect, which I'm, again, not going to talk about too much, is that if you look at the real signal traces, then perhaps you can see that the amplitude of the signal, in other words, the amount by which the resistance of the wire is decreased, actually depends on the domain wall velocity. And with increasing velocity, you see here, if you look here, this is the signal. Well, this is a small signal. Here you can see it's about twice as big. So the signal is increasing with the domain wall velocity. And that's consistent with this turbulent motion, that essentially the domain wall width is a dynamic quantity that increases with its velocity. It's bigger, therefore the resistance change is larger for greater velocities. We can also say, well, that means since the signal at low field is constant with along the as the domain wall moves along the wire, that the domain wall is not changing its structure as it moves along the wire. Now, okay, so we have actually the model that Yaroslav Basiuli put together, and the most important, I'm not going to go into the model, but the conclusion is, I mentioned non-adiabaticity. It turns out that we find the Walker breakdown field is independent of the current we apply to the wire, the spin torque. And it turns out that that is exactly corresponds in these models to the damping and the non-adiabatic contribution being equal. So what that says is that these experiments show that there is a very significant non-adiabatic term to the current domain wall interaction. Now in the last 2 minutes, I just want to talk about a final very interesting experiment. So, which is, we're going to do something slightly different. We're going to now inject a domain wall into the bend of a wire. So here's a wire with a bend. This is a very nice approach to putting domain walls into wire that Teru Ono first used at Kyoto. And it's very simple. Again, if we apply a magnetic field at a 45 degree angle, in fact at an arbitrary angle to the wire, then as you can see here, the two legs of the wires will be follow the direction of the field. And when we return the field to zero because of hysteresis, we end up with a domain wall in the bend of this wire. By changing the angle of that field, we can actually put the domain wall in any position along the wire. So it's kind of neat. We can put it wherever we want. Now, what we're going to do, and here's a vortex wall we can see in our curved wire. Again, we're going to detect the presence of this domain wall by the presence of the wire. And what we're going to do then is look, so go back, we're going to look, put a domain wall in, and now we're going to apply a current pulse and again see when does the domain wall exit this wire. But the current we're going to be used is smaller than the current needed to depin the domain wall in the DC state. So we know there's a threshold current, just discussed it. We're going to apply a current smaller than that to the domain wall. What happens? And this is what happens. Now this is a plot of the probability of depinning the domain wall from that pinning site, where blue means probability of zero. Red means very high. And then what you can see, and this is a plot then as a function of different directions of current and amplitude and field and time. So you can see here that we're seeing a very beautiful oscillatory dependence of the probability of depinning the domain wall on the length of the current pulse. And similarly, there's some complicated dependence on amplitude too. So let's just concentrate, since we're running out of time. The probability of depinning the domain wall from that bend depends on the length of the current pulse. So it goes from 1 to 0 on a frequency of about 3.5 nanoseconds. So if we have a short period, we depin the domain wall, we increase it by 50%, no probability of depinning. So we see this fantastic, very strong oscillatory dependence of the probability of depinning the domain wall on the length of the current pulse. Now I want to explain, we can fully understand this. And many of you will be familiar with this one-dimensional model for a domain wall. In a one-dimensional model, which is a model developed by, in particular, Alex Malazimov and John Sonzeski and others, you assume that the profile of the domain wall is unchanged as the domain wall moves along a wire. And you characterize the domain wall by two quantities, the position of the domain wall along the wire, Q, and the angle by which the moments come out of the plane of the wire. In these wires, which are essentially two-dimensional, the moments prefer to lie in plane because of demagnetizing fields. So we have an angle out of the plane. And what happens? We can describe then this motion by Landau, Lifshitz, Gilbert equation, standard equation with a term representing the spin torque. So what do we find? If we look then in this phase space of this angle and the position, and under DC current, what happens? So initially, we're at the position zero and angle zero. When we apply DC current, then the phi and Q will oscillate in this fashion till they reach this stable equilibrium point where the angle is rotated out of the plane of the wire depending upon the magnitude of the current. This is what happens as a function of time for Q, the position of the wire and the angle. They oscillate out of phase together. And, well, what happens then when we cut the current pulse here after 9 nanoseconds? Well, it's like a spinning top. If you have a spinning top and it's high energy, the angular momentum, nevertheless, even though it has very high energy, will maintain that motion. Now, in this case, what we're doing is we're putting in spin angular momentum, which is essentially causing the whole domain wall to rotate in this way. And even though it has a lot of energy, what happens is when we cut off the current pulse, depending upon where we cut it off, then it'll relax and the domain wall will leave this potential or not. So we can describe that here. In this case here, this is what happens in the, if we continue the pulse indefinitely, reach an equilibrium state where the domain wall will remain in the well, but with this rotated angle. Here we cut off the pulse and you can see the angle phi will go to zero and the domain wall will leave the potential as shown here. So it turns out then, you can see very easily, depending upon the length of the current pulse, in this case 11 nanoseconds, then we cut it off here, then the momentum of the domain wall and the relaxation will cause it to stay in the potential. In the previous case, we cut it off, so the momentum of the domain wall will allow it to leave the notch. And then 2 nanoseconds later, stays in the notch. 2 nanoseconds later, leaves the notch. And that's how we can understand it. It's either deep end or trapped, depending upon where, red, it's deep end, black, it's trapped, depending upon where we cut the current pulse. So we basically have this macroscopic object which is rotating under the influence of this current, and it has momentum. When we cut off the current, it continues to move, and depending upon where it is in that motion, it leaves the potential. So we can understand this by simulations. So just the last 2 minutes, I wanted to say that one-dimensional model is very simple. So you might say, well, a real domain wall is a much more complex object. What happens? And of course, we've discussed transverse vortex walls, more complicated walls, very complex wall structures. Does this model apply to real systems? And it turns out then that it does. So I can't really discuss that. Let me just show you the result. Here then, in a simulation, this is by Luke Thomas. He spent a lot of time simulating this wall. Here's a transverse wall, and you can see this pulse is rather long, half a nanosecond, and you could see that it left. Can you see it left? It came back again. It didn't come back, it left. And that was 400 nanoseconds, so it, that's what it does. Now, we make it a little bit longer. Now you can see it doesn't do anything, it just oscillates around and in a rather complex fashion. Doesn't leave the wall, and then finally here, again you can see much longer, a little longer pulse. Eventually, you see it's traveling, it's moving away from that pinning site. So again, depending upon where, these are now just plots of the two components of magnetization. Depending upon where we cut the current pulse, it will leave or not leave the notch. So just let me summarize. So firstly, magnetic racetrack memory, I think, is an interesting new approach to building a solid-state memory with no moving parts that could possibly replace a magnetic disk drive and certainly replace flash if we can, well, do certain things. And the experimental findings we have are that, interestingly, the D-pinning current is insensitive to the pinning potential for these domain walls. It's also insensitive to the domain wall structure, and we can clearly introduce domain walls with different structures, but what is the role of heating? We're not entirely sure. And the domain wall velocity, well, Hideo mentioned this morning, very low velocities that most people have measured. We can certainly see velocities of 100 meters per second or so in combination with very small magnetic fields. And we can also show then that because of this precessional rotation of domain walls, we can actually de-pin domain walls at current densities 10 times lower than the DC current density from the same pinning potential. So we have a lot of interesting challenges left. Firstly, detailed understanding is missing of the current-induced domain wall motion, and, well, we have all these things. So, thank you so much for your patience. Thank you.
Okay, questions?
Is the intent to put me out of job? Oh. Hmm.
Yeah.
So, the first and obvious question would be,
Oh, Fountain of Wealth, yeah.
So in order to make it viable commercially, it has to have a
consumption rate, but it'll still be connected to the data. Okay, well, the power consumption will, of course, depend on the currents we need to move the domain walls. So that, currently, the domain walls, the currents are quite high. But we believe that it's, since very few materials have been studied, thermaloid, gallium, manganese, arsenic, that's it, that there will be other materials where we can reduce the current density by orders of magnitude. That's what we fundamentally believe. So it's, and there's lots of ways of doing it. And there are lots of other clever schemes, we think, I think, where we can reduce this current density by many orders of magnitude. So I don't think it's a problem. Therefore, power is not a problem. That's the answer.
Paul?
Well, I mean, it's right. So we can control it. Right. Well, we have so many parameters to play with that we can do whatever we want. Anyway. That's what we think.
Go ahead.
Yeah, okay, so, well, it certainly is a different material, that's one thing. And the velocity, so our experiments appear to show much higher velocities than other people reported. However, most of the other experiments for permalloy have involved very long current pulses of the order of microseconds. And then, as you can see from our experiments on this gyrotropic motion, then whether you're at a microsecond or a nanosecond, they're totally different regimes. So we believe that possibly in this much shorter time scales, the velocity may be quite different. On the other hand, it's also true that tiny magnetic fields can strongly influence the domain wall velocity. We can see that the Walker breakdown field, which is very small, of the order of, in our case, 9 ersteds, that 9 ersted field will give a velocity of 200 meters per second. So that means you have to be extraordinarily careful in all your experiments with the small magnetic fields. On the other hand, it also provides a handle. It says that if you can control local magnetic fields, you can dramatically increase the velocity. So if we can cleverly introduce some scheme to provide local magnetic fields depending upon the chirality of the domain wall, then that's a mechanism whereby we believe we can vastly increase the domain wall velocity. And so it's something we're working on. Well, all the wires have some roughness, so effectively the edges of the wire have some roughness, and then that you can see from the propagation field that depending on how you make the wire, you can have smaller or larger propagation fields. And in many other experiments, the propagation fields are quite large because the walls are rough. They don't have to be physically rough, they can be magnetically rough through oxidation and other means. Well, it turns out that that's a very interesting question, but the problem is, because we are so significantly heating the wires, that it's tough to answer that question. So Matthias Klaue has some nice results where he's shown, appears to show, that for the same current density, the degree he claims, he argues, that the degree of heating of the wire depends on the bath temperature. And so he, to some extent, has looked at that, and he sees a dependence on temperature of the depinning of these motion of the domain walls. In our case, we think that the temperature is so high, it's difficult to answer that question currently.
So I have a question for you, Stuart. So, since you want to do this cheap, haven't you done it on diamond to get your heat sinking better?
Our approach is we just need to reduce the current density, so we don't need to use diamond.
We could try diamond and see if it makes a difference.
We could, well, yeah, but we don't really need to do that. We know the answer. Yeah. Quite right, so we've done that, and you can indeed, because as we've discussed, you can indeed, as you said, you can essentially, just like a spinning top, you can inject momentum at the right time, and we've done that, and by using the proper sequence, even two short pulses, but the right amount of time, you can reduce the current density needed to move the domain walls by a factor of 5 to 10. So we think that's totally possible, and we've in fact demonstrated that. Right. So again, it's a question. That's when we have currents, sub-threshold currents. So if we use super-threshold currents, then it's not a problem. So it's a question of we can certainly vary this current to solve that problem. Or alternatively, we can change, for example, the damping of the material by introducing impurities. So there are ways to eliminate jar dropping motion. Okay. Okay. So just in case somebody asks a question, then I have this foil. I just wasn't going to show it because it's just no, technology.
653.
Yeah. So let's see if we go here. Okay. So I like to show this foil. So it turns out, when I first proposed doing this, people said exactly that, and then the head, the director of all of IBM's research into semiconductor technology, T.C. Chen, he sent me this foil. He said, turns out that IBM, we can already do this, turns out. Well, IBM, the way we build DRAM, embedded DRAM, in our ASICs, is to build a trench. It turns out the trench is 10 microns tall and 0.09 microns wide. So it turns out it's even better than we needed. And here is a nice cross-section of multiple. You see all these are individual trenches, closely spaced. And in this SEM picture, you can see at the top and the bottom and the middle that the width of this wire is essentially unchanged. So we think it's possible. We just need to, this is a hole, we just need to fill it with magnetic material by plating. Say it again. Yeah. Well, not really, because all we have to do is that the domain wall has to move from one pinning site to the next one. So we have to make sure that by the time it gets to the next site, whatever time it takes, it doesn't leave the next site. So we can, so it's a threshold. It's between your so two, you have to be between two currents. It's not important.
If I remember correctly, at the beginning of your talk, you said you wanted 1,000 meters per second.
Yeah.
And now you're at 100.
Well, we've just been working a short time, so we just extrapolate forward. 1,000, maybe 5 years, we'll get to 1,000 meters.
So what's it going to take to get it to go to 1,000? That's what.
Well, I think it turns out that a lot of interesting effects. Of course, simple ballistic transport might help considerably, for example. The Fermi velocity plays a very significant role. Of course, the polarization, if we can increase the polarization of the current. Oh, there's a whole variety of things. So I think the problem currently models, the fundamental interaction is poorly understood, and I think there's very little work on different materials. So I think once we've looked at different materials, we'll have a very much better understanding. It may not be possible.
Okay, that's a perfect time to do 1,000 meters per second to the coffee break. Reconvene at 3:30.